Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Well, good evening once again. Day 154 of the Biden administration. The Democrats have been blocked in the U.S. Senate today. They lost a vote that would have allowed just the discussion of voting rights. All 50 Democratic senators voted in favor of advancing the For the People Act, including West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin, whose support wasn't secured until late this afternoon, but it didn't matter. The Democrats needed 10 Republicans to cross over and go along to get the 60 votes they need to break a filibuster. But not one Republican voted in favor of even allowing debate on the legislation. Put another way, all 50 Republican senators voted no. While states are back home working hard to suppress the vote, or certain votes, should we say, there's not a Republican in the Senate who wants to even allow a debate on this topic. An angry majority leader spoke moments after the vote was announced.
Senate Republicans have signed their names in the ledger of history alongside Donald Trump, the big lie, and voter suppression. Today, every single Democratic senator stood together in the fight to protect the right to vote in America. The Republican leader uses the language and the logic of the Southern senators in the 60s who defended states' rights. This vote, I'm ashamed to say, is further evidence that voter suppression has become part of the official platform of the Republican Party.
In an unusual move, Vice President Harris presided over the Senate during tonight's vote. Afterwards, she vowed Democrats will continue pushing for federal voting rights legislation.
When we're talking about the right to vote, it is not a Republican concern or a Democratic concern. It is an American concern. This is about the American people's right to vote, unfettered. It is about their access to the right to vote in a meaningful way. Because nobody is debating, I don't believe, whether all Americans have the right to vote. The bottom line is that the president and I are very clear. We support S1. We support the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And the fight is not over.
Since January of this year, just since January, at least 14 states have enacted 22 new laws that restrict access to voting. And right now, there are at least 61 bills with restrictive provisions moving through 18 other state legislatures. Yet Senate Republicans maintain, as was evident in tonight's vote, that there's no reason for the federal government to step in here.
There is no effort in any state in America to suppress votes based upon suppression of minority participation. What this is really about is an effort for the federal government to take over the way we conduct elections in this country. It is a solution in search of a problem. Regardless of what may be happening in some state, there's no rationale for federal intervention.
The Democrats' only real hope of passing any kind of elections overhaul now seems to hang on a long shot bid to eliminate the filibuster. Tonight, the president issued a statement that read in part, quote, "Unfortunately, a Democratic stand to protect our democracy met a solid Republican wall of opposition. It was the suppression of a bill to end voter suppression, another attack on voting rights that is sadly not unprecedented." Biden added he'll have more to say next week about election reform. While there was no sign of bipartisanship, of course, in tonight's vote, that's the problem. The Biden administration is still hoping for more luck with their infrastructure bill. White House has started meeting with senators from both sides of the aisle who are working on their own version of a bill. Tomorrow, Schumer and Pelosi sit down with administration officials to talk about it further. Also tomorrow, Biden lays out his plan to try to stop a nationwide wave of violent crimes. Today, the Justice Department said it is creating a new strike force to target gun trafficking in five cities. Also today, the White House acknowledged it won't meet the president's original goal of getting 70% of us vaccinated by Independence Day. Tonight, Dr. Fauci said the focus is still on reaching as many people as possible.
We're almost at the 70% vaccination with one dose of adults when we reach the 4th of July. If we don't get it by then, we're going to get it within a week or so. But we don't want to stop there. That's an aspirational goal. The goal line is crushing the virus with as many vaccinations as you possibly can.
There is also a major political story developing tonight, a local race with national implications. Big suspense tonight in the Big Apple. Today was primary day in New York City, the city's first ever ranked choice election, apparently because there was something too easy about voting for only that one candidate. If history is an indicator, the Democrat who wins tonight's primary will go on to be mayor in the heavily Democratic city. Polls closed a few hours ago. We've got Steve Kornacki standing by at the big board to explain why there could be a delay in announcing a winner, which is not helping the suspense in New York. And already tonight, one big name has conceded. Then there's the matter of one former New York City resident. In other New York news with national implications, there's this. NBC News confirming the Manhattan DA is indeed investigating Trump's former bodyguard, Matthew Calamari, who is now an executive at the Trump Organization. NBC News confirming Calamari and his son have indeed hired outside counsel to represent them. With that, let's bring in our leadoff guests on this Tuesday night. Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Cynthia Auxney, former federal prosecutor in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And Sam Stein, a veteran journalist who's now White House editor over at Politico. Sam, indeed, I'd like to begin with you, and I'd like to play this for you and our audience. We'll discuss on the other side. This is Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah tonight.
This bill was written in hell by the devil himself. This bill wouldn't make it easier to vote. This would make it easier to vote illegally. This is the Corrupt Politicians Act. If there's any chance this becomes law, it would be devastating for the country. This would be bad for everyone other than Democratic political incumbents.
So, Sam, how's bipartisanship going? And if that was meant for outreach for the Democratic Party, I think the senator has to work on his communication skills.
First and foremost, I don't think the devil wrote the bill. I think that's hyperbole. A bill was written by a number of Democratic lawmakers. It was amended, although that was never brought to a vote, by Joe Manchin to include at least one very Republican-oriented idea, which was a version of voter identification. Manchin's provision would have said you had to bring something akin to a utility bill in order to vote. So I think it's fair to say that Democrats did try to move a little bit in the Republican direction in order to win the votes. But really, there was never a chance that they would. This was, I don't want to call it a messaging exercise that sort of diminishes it. This was an exercise in showing where the cards were, essentially. This was Democrats saying, look, we have 50 votes in our caucus. We want to move this bill. We notice what's going on in the states, state houses around the country. Let's see what Republicans have to say in response. And what the Republicans said in response was not just what Mike Lee said on Fox News tonight, but a resounding no to consideration of this debate. Big question now, Brian, is where do we go from here? What other cards does Biden have to play? What other maneuvers does the White House have? Our reporters have talked to White House officials about this. They can see there's not much they can do, though they're looking for different avenues, whether it's consulting with state house Democrats or leaning on corporate America to do essentially what they did in Georgia, which was apply pressure to lawmakers in the states to not go down this path. Neither of those options are particularly fruitful. So the White House is kind of stuck.
Jonathan Lemire, Stein just tossed you the ball. Pick it up and run with it. Where do we go from here?
Well, Brian, I keep it as a personal policy not to agree with Sam Stein very often, but he is largely right about all of this. The administration does feel like their hands are relatively tied. We should expect more public pressure from the White House. An aide signaled to us earlier today, soon after this bill's defeat in the Senate, that we'd be hearing more from the president on this, and his statement backed that up, that we should expect him to have not just public comments, but perhaps an event that's still being put together on this next week. We did hear from the vice president sort of speaking, but let's be candid, she's speaking powerfully about the need to protect the right to vote. You know, in her remarks earlier today after she presided in the Senate, but they're short of something really significant at the state level. Their only move here would indeed be to embark on some sort of filibuster reform. But the problem is there aren't too many Democrats who are willing to do that, or at least not enough. Joe Manchin, of course, is the leading figure of this, but he's far from alone. Kyrsten Sinema, another, she wrote in the Washington Post in an op-ed just the other day saying it's not something she supported. And we also know that there are some other Democratic senators who privately agree with them, but are happy to let them be the public face of this opposition. So short of that, this is going to be potentially a real disappointment for the Democrats and for Biden himself, who has said repeatedly this is a lifelong mission of his to expand the access to the franchise, that he would do anything it would require to defend this, to expand the voting rights. This is an existential threat against democracy. It's part of his larger picture to prove that democracies still work against autocracies globally. It's harder sell if he can't say that their democracies are protecting the right to vote at home. So this is a legislative agenda that is quite full right now. But this is something that, though a huge priority for Democrats, may not be something they can actually enact anytime soon without some sort of sweeping 11th hour change.
Cynthia, my friend, over to you. I don't say it often, but we need a lawyer. What is your level of fear for our country and a free and fair election if we don't have a federal remedy, something new where voter suppression is concerned?
Well, I'm pretty scared about it. You know, I live in Florida where just about anything goes these days with our governor. So I'm hoping very much that we'll figure out a way to get some of these bills passed, and particularly anything having to do with protecting this minority vote, because it looks like the Republicans will do almost anything to figure out a way to make it impossible for people to vote if they don't have just the right ID, or if they move, or if they do anything. So I am hoping that we can come to some agreement with Manchin and Sinema. It just doesn't seem very likely to me.
Okay, Sam Stein, you are the recipient of tonight's video Daily Double. I got another one for you. This is Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, tonight. We'll discuss on the other side.
What's next? We're going to Georgia. When the people of Georgia saw what was happening back in early January, when they saw the big lie being perpetrated on them, when they saw their elections being undermined by the Republican Party, they turned out and they voted. They didn't just vote in one Democratic senator, they voted in two. So we are not ending this fight. And one of the ways we do that is getting out of this Capitol dome and heading out to the states.
Sam, I'm just a guy asking questions here, but why take a victory lap of excitement over a field trip to Georgia already represented in the Senate by two Democrats? It's an uncontested yes, yes vote to any voter measures in the Senate. Why not, and I'm just putting this out here, go to a state with one or more Republican senators?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the logic here is that Senator Warnock is up again in this coming cycle. He was a critical, obviously, the 50th vote, but I guess all of them are 50th votes for Democrats. But, you know, Georgia is the epicenter, the tip of the spear for voting rights legislation right now. And, you know, there is something to it, Brian, where the intense focus on these suppression laws actually has a sort of boomerang effect, in that it inspires Democrats to defy the legislation and go to the polls. So I don't think she's wrong there. But the real elections that Democrats need to worry about are not the federal elections. I mean, what we're seeing now is the residual impact of Democrats just getting bludgeoned down ballot, losing statehouse after statehouse, to the point where they can't have an impact on these voting rights laws in the states. Not only that, but that they're not going to be able to impact redistricting, which is coming up soon too. So, you know, the Democratic Party tends to be way too focused for their own good on the national high-profile elections, and they forget that the lower chamber statehouse elections are the ones that actually are really determinative of how these laws progress. So, you know, if they're going to Georgia, they should look at, House seats, the statehouse seats, the state senate seats too.
Yeah, it's been a real colossal drop ball over the past couple of cycles. So, Jonathan Lemire, again, I'm just a guy asking questions. A whole bunch of Democrats out there are angry. To the aforementioned national Democrats, they would like to see a level of anger from them. Chuck Schumer gets angry in the course of a 3,000-word statement in the well of the Senate. To you and the beat you cover, when are Democrats going to see their president get angry over the kind of thing that happened today more than a release statement on paper?
Brian, that's a, you hit on something there that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about today. And that was before the For the People Act was went down. But it was the writing was on the wall. And basically, she was said she was questioned, why hasn't the president done more here? And, you know, if this is indeed, a, as he has put it, a lifelong passion, why hasn't he used the bully pulpit more? And she rebutted that, saying that, well, he, you know, he puts out statements and he has said this now and then. And but the question was pointed again, like, well, where was he today? Why wasn't this more of a priority as this became, as this faced its fate in the Senate? And she didn't really have a good answer for that. And I think that the White House now is trying to suggest that a course will be corrected. But look, this is a White House and a president in particular who has, who knows how to count votes. And he has decades of experience in the Senate. And there just doesn't seem to be a path for this. Even the compromise, the Senator Manchin, he of much interest in recent days, you know, put out last week was immediately shot down by Republicans. There's no bipartisan buy-in on this. The Republicans have suggested this would basically end democracy as we know it, which, of course, is a gross overstatement. But that's how they're selling it to them, to themselves, to their caucus, but also to their voters. They're not going to be giving an inch, it seems, even on a compromise bill. So, yes, this would seem to be the moment for righteous anger from Democrats. We heard a little bit from the vice president today. We haven't yet from the president, and maybe that will change. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the legislation is going to change. And I think that we, in fact, that for a White House that has been so careful in sequencing its legislation, the voting rights really wasn't at the top of their list. It was COVID relief first, infrastructure now, its fate still hanging in the balance. We're going to hear from them on crime and guns tomorrow. Certainly still there's other things to tackle as well. But right now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of hope. And it will be interesting to see if this president can summon that fury to maybe move people in the coming days. But I wouldn't bet on it.
Cynthia, you get the last word tonight. And while it's true that Trump and Trumpism has infused our entire conversation as we start off the broadcast tonight, doesn't it always come down to calamari? Let's go local to New York and the Manhattan DA investigation. What does it say to you as a veteran former Fed that Mr. Calamari, formerly hired muscle, now in the executive ranks, is under such scrutiny, enough scrutiny that he and his son apparently are lawyering up?
Right. Well, he's a new focus of the investigation. I will say he doesn't strike me as the central focus of the investigation. And if he were, it would be a sign that the investigation was in trouble. I mean, I had the unfortunate experience of watching some of the old reruns of The Apprentice today and saw Mr. Calamari. And let me just say lovingly, he's probably not the brains of the organization. That brains of the organization is Mr. Weisselberger. And that is the central focus of the investigation. And if they can't flip him, they're going to have to indict him if they want to get some information, and they're going to have to call his bluff. And apparently now he's saying, I'm not going to flip, and they're going to have to do something. And reportedly they're going to do something this summer. We'll see if they really do. The other person to really watch is the woman from Deutsche Bank. The person who handled many of the Trump finances. That's somebody to watch. I do not think Calamari is the central focus or the be-all and end-all in this investigation.
We are much obliged to our big three on this Tuesday night, to Sam Stein, to Jonathan Lemire, and Cynthia Oxney down in Florida, where apparently old reruns of The Apprentice run on the air 24/7. Thanks, gang. Appreciate you starting us off tonight. Coming up for us, when is a race for mayor national news? Well, the answer, when there are more people in the city than there are people in 38 different states. Steve Kornacki standing by for us at the big board to explain the returns tonight in the New York City mayor's race. Also coming up, Democrats won a battle with Joe Manchin right before they lost the war, for now at least. We'll talk strategy with two veteran political watchers. And later, a mask-free 4th of July for much of our country, but a race against time to get enough Americans vaccinated by fall. One of our doctors explains its importance to all of us. All of it, as the 11th hour is just getting underway on this Tuesday night.
But you all know I am a numbers guy. I'm someone who traffics in what's happening by the numbers. And I am not going to be the next mayor of New York City based upon the numbers that have come in tonight.
John Yang dropping out of the race for mayor in New York, election night in the biggest city in our country. We're going to check in on the mayor's race. And before we go to Steve Kornacki at the big board, just 2 points to make. First, today's election is only a primary, but on the Democratic side, the city is so blue, the winner almost automatically goes on to be mayor. And about the job itself, the mayor of New York City has more constituents than 76 of our U.S. senators. Put another way, the population of the city is higher than 38 of our 50 states. As you're about to hear, that was the easy part. New York does nothing simply. Tonight's election, no different. Let's go to Steve at the big board. Steve, good luck.
All right, Brian. Well, let's take you through what we know and what we still don't. What you're seeing here, these are the votes that have been counted tonight. These are, it says first choice here because that's the way ranked choice voting, which they're doing in New York City for the first time. That's the way it works. When you went in to vote in this primary day, if you did, you could check off your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, all the way through your fifth choice. What the city said it would release tonight is the first choice for all of the in-person votes, meaning folks who went and voted today and folks who voted early. So this is most, probably just about all of those votes, the first choice preference there. Now, there are still a chunk of mail-in ballots that aren't even going to be open for another week. And so when you factor those in, these numbers can and perhaps will change a bit. But I want to emphasize some things are becoming clear here. You saw Andrew Yang conceding defeat tonight. Yang and everybody south of him, you see here in this first choice. Clearly, mathematically, they are not going to win this. Now, their second, third, you know, their voters' preferences, you know, if you voted for Yang, you know, who your second choice was on that ballot is going to matter here. But Yang won't win. Stringer won't win. The winner will be one of these three candidates: Eric Adams, Maya Wiley, Catherine Garcia. And the lead right now that Adams has over both Wiley and Garcia is potentially significant. Ranked choice voting has been done. It's not that widespread right now, but it's been around in a number of places for a while. And in fact, if you look at every ranked choice election that's taken place in this country, really in the history of ranked choice voting, the biggest margin that somebody who's finished in the first choice round outside of first place, the biggest gap that's been overcome to win one of these things has been 9.3 points, you know, from the first choice. Wiley right now, if you play it out to the decimal point, is 9.2 points behind Eric Adams. Now, again, there are mail-in ballots that will be counted. Maybe this thing will get tighter when those are counted. There are still a few more votes to come in tonight, but I think it's clear Eric Adams is going to lead on the first choice when the first choice votes are all tabulated. And then in about a week or two, they'll run through all these multiple rounds of voting. But the history of ranked choice voting has been the candidate who finishes first in the first choice has tended to win, not automatically. And when the lead is as big as Adams is right now, very, very high probability of winning. So the question is, the mail votes, the remaining votes, can Wiley or Garcia make this thing a little closer, perhaps? And then when they do those retabulations through the complicated ranked choice system, could they somehow overtake? It would take a lot for them to pull it out. Not impossible, but it would take a lot, Brian.
My friend, thank you for gently correcting me. A friend of mine for many years, correspondent for many years at our network, John Yang. I'm used to saying his name. I've made that mistake with Andrew Yang, now former candidate, many times. We're flattered and lucky to have you on the broadcast and, more importantly, at the big board tonight, because it's a lot and it's confusing. Steve Kornacki, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
With me now, two more friends of this broadcast. A.B. Stoddard, veteran Washington journalist and associate editor and columnist for Real Clear Politics. And Michael Steele, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, former lieutenant governor of the great state of Maryland, also happens to be the host of the Michael Steele podcast. Michael, I'd like to begin with you and speak on behalf of all the viewers who, like me, found that last segment just too hard mathematically. Was it too simple to vote for one candidate? And was there a check off on the form that if we're out of the chicken, the fish is okay?
That's essentially it. Yeah. And there are people who like fish and chicken. And I think it's good and appropriate that our voting system seemingly is trying to accommodate that now, to give people better options and better choices for people who disengage and step back from politics because they support someone who everyone else, the conventional wisdom, says, oh, well, they're a gadfly or they're not part of the traditional lot of candidates. Well, with ranked choice and other forms of balloting that are taking shape in various states right now, they're opening up that possibility. And what it means, particularly on the heels of what happened in the Senate today with the voting rights measure, it's giving the voters the incentive to participate. And you know, to say, look, okay, your first choice may not be everyone else's first choice, but they could be their second choice. And that's the point that, you know, Steve was just driving for Maya and Catherine, is that, okay, yeah, you're sitting at this percentage right now, but there are still a lot more votes to come in. And voters had the option to maybe perhaps pick you as their second choice, which changed the dynamics of the voting process. And that's a good thing for the country.
AB, first of all, I'm stunned by our friend Michael's magnanimity on this topic, but we'll move on. And I'm not saying, but just saying, if you had to write a column tonight on Deadline, the column could be, could it not, while there is a discussion in Washington and out in the states on restricting the vote in New York, where they've been open for days and they have a robust mail-in effort and open late at night for hours on the actual primary day, has such a luxury of elections, they have filled an IHOP menu with your choice of candidates.
I'm a big fan of ranked choice voting. I don't think it's that complicated. People get to go and pick the chicken or the fish and then, you know, rank the other menu choices below. It's only five, and then leave it to the computers to do the tabulation. I'm biggest fan of final five voting, which gets rid of the primary, the partisan primary, and gives you an open primary. You pick five choices and those five campaign for the general election. And they campaign nicely because they know that they want to be people's second choice. So they don't, they campaign on a platform and mm-hmm. results for voters instead of campaigning against each other. That said, if I was writing a column tonight, I would also be tempted, Brian, to focus on the fact that if Maya Wiley doesn't prevail and AOC's endorsement didn't get her over the edge, NYC is not the progressive stronghold that they think that it was. And that's a big warning to progressives. So I think it's going to be an interesting part of the divide as you see progressives get louder with the Biden administration in the months to come, and how they all try to pull together their coalitions before the midterms where they're going to take a beating.
Yeah, indeed. If further, the winner tonight, the guy who prevails, is a former Republican, former police officer in New York City, who ran on a tough on crime platform in the middle of a post-pandemic crime wave that no one can deny. I'm getting ahead of myself. Both of our friends are going to stay with us through the break. We're going to talk about the Democrats. We're going to talk about what happened in the Senate today when we come right back.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories.
But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
This is not dead. This is not dead.
Today we're ringing the bell on round one of the fight. We'll come back for round two and round three.
In the fight for voting rights, this vote was the starting gun, not the finish line.
So if you want to hear how it's not dead, you're not alone tonight. Back with us are A.B. Stoddard and Michael Steele. A.B., if you come on one night a week, I quote you on the other four, so I hope you get your residual checks for all five nights. I have been quoting you for so long. You called what happened today a mile away. The Democrats have no game over 50. So what do you do, and do you trash the bill, put it in the trash, rewrite, start over, and present the full Senate with something fresh?
I do think that Joe Biden, as quiet as he's been, is well aware of these negotiations with Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin talks to Schumer almost every day, meets with him at least once a week in a small leadership huddle. And none of this is a secret. So there are two tracks they're taking. He's either going to come up with a new bill that he negotiates with Republicans, which he didn't on this quick compromise fully, and that's something he could get 10 Republicans on, or he will back down on some kind of filibuster reform, not the elimination of the legislative filibuster. So those are the two paths that both majority leader and the president are aware they have to follow. We will find out which one Joe Manchin's going to take them down. He might want to drag Republicans on the record first, but I think those are the two options that they have left.
Michael Steele, here is our mutual friend Nicole Wallace on the topic of the filibuster on her broadcast today.
The idea that there's political peril in doing away with it, I think, is faulty. The other thing that I hear more and more on TV, and I hear a whole lot off TV, is that there's political peril in leaving it in place. I think there's real political peril in all this failure to deliver in 2 years. So I think they're choosing between bad and worse. And I think today the worse is leaving the filibuster in place.
Michael Steele, how is she wrong? Do you agree?
I mean, I think that's, you know, really to AB's point, that's more and more the reality that the Democrats are confronting right now is how do they get over this obstinate hurdle known as the Republican minority in the Senate? Republicans have been very clear what they intend to do, and that is to give the Democrats nothing. There is no incentive, regardless of what Joe Manchin thinks, says, or puts in front of them. There's no incentive for Republicans to give Joe Biden and his administration a win on anything. And I think the sooner Democrats realize that truth, the sooner they'll be able to come up with a strategy to overcome it. But right now, they're just spinning wheels. And I think that's really the basis of Nicole's point.
Michael, I've got about 20 seconds left. What about a Democratic tour to at least blue dots in red states? Go right at them, media markets, TV, newspaper, TV ads, and appeal to people in red states represented by red senators.
5 months too late, but okay, do it. that you do out
you
of
the sound
gates.
A lot like my friend A.B. Stoddard.
A.B.'s right. I mean, yeah. The political juggernaut instincts, work it.
Thank you both. What a day we've just witnessed, but we wanted to have you both on. A.B. Stoddard, Michael Steele, our guest tonight, with our thanks. Coming up for us, a new warning from Dr. Fauci on this Delta variant as virus rates increase in some areas of our country, sadly.
The vaccines we have do protect well against the Delta variant. So if ever there was a reason to get vaccinated, it's right now, because we're seeing this Delta variant double every 2 weeks. We're up to 20.6% of the isolates now are Delta variants.
CDC numbers show vaccination rates lagging in several states. Today, the First Lady was in one of those states, in Mississippi, where she tried to comfort a nervous patient, kid who did not like needles. She covered his eyes while he got his vaccination at Jackson State University. In Missouri, where less than half the overall population has received even the first shot, new COVID cases are the highest recorded in any state. We welcome back Dr. Erwin Redlener, the founding director of Columbia's National Center for Disaster Preparedness, who advises us on public health. He's also a columnist with the Daily Beast. Doc, after the pandemic we have been through, when Dr. Fauci uses a phrase about anything that is, you know, doubling every 2 weeks, it really focuses the mind. And I assume you concur with his assessment of this Delta variant and the potential danger it poses to us, even though we think we're through it.
Yeah, and this is why we've been proceeding with sort of cautious optimism. Yes, we've made a lot of progress, Brian, as you well know, but I think we have to be careful not to overpromise ourselves that we're done with this, because we're not. And in the wings is waiting this Delta variant and maybe more variants later. I don't want to be Dr. Doom here, but I do feel it's important that we not get ahead of ourselves and we keep pushing people to get vaccinated, because like Dr. Fauci has said numerous times, the vaccine will help prevent even the Delta variant. But for those people, which are many, many people throughout the Southeast in particular, there is a problem, because people are not getting vaccinated at the rate that they should be. And they are in danger, Brian, and there's no two ways about it.
We're going to fall short of that July 4th benchmark of 70% of the souls in our country having been vaccinated. Does the sledding get really tough after July 4th?
Well, I think we'll get there to the 70% in the next couple of weeks. But will that be enough? I don't know. We'll have to see. And the problem is the patchwork of the picture in the United States. We're doing great in New York and many other places in the northern parts of the country. But in the southern parts of the country, in Missouri, in Alabama, in Mississippi, and Arkansas, we have very low rates of vaccination, with very large numbers of people who are not just hesitant, Brian, they're actually resistant. They're the anti-vaxxers who are not going to budge. And we're potentially going to have a problem in those areas where the vaccination rates are low and the vaccination is going really quite slowly. And I think we're all kind of concerned about that.
What should the messaging be, since by training and trade, you are a pediatrician first and foremost? What should the messaging be to young people, some of the holdouts in our country?
So there's this sense of, immortality among a lot of people. And I think probably you and I experienced a bit of that at those ages as well. The problem is there's been nothing like this before for the 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, and they really have to pay attention, because a lot of people are getting sick. Even children are getting sick. And I think there's been a little bit of a lightness in the approach of young people getting vaccinated. And I think we need them to step it up, really as an example to other Americans. But we need 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds to kind of say, I need the vaccine and I need it now. And I think if we can break loose there, I think we can make some big progress. But it's going to take some messaging, by the way, by people who are peers of those who seem to be resistant or hesitant. It's not going to be, the older sect that's going to actually be that influential with people that are younger. And I think we ought to find peers, We have been doing that, and government's been looking to do that. Peers who can speak the language of folks who are still resistant or hesitant about getting a vaccine.
I can indeed confirm fleeting feelings of immortality until I blew out my knee in high school football. It was all over then. Dr. Erwin Redliner, a friend of this broadcast, has been our guest tonight, taking our questions about this pandemic so far without end. Coming up and staying on topic, how do you welcome the world to the Olympic Games when the virus is still rampant in your country? Well, we're all about to find out, indeed, from the comfort of our homes. Tomorrow marks exactly 1 month till the opening ceremony of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And even though the city reported another 430 new COVID cases today alone, even though a tiny fraction of its citizens have been vaccinated, fans will be allowed to attend, though in limited numbers. There will, in fact, be strict precautions in place, as we learned tonight from NBC News foreign correspondent Keir Simmons.
Tonight, with Olympic trials underway around the world, the president of Tokyo 2020 telling NBC News in an exclusive interview, the games will be a blessing, but there may be difficult days. If an athlete is confirmed COVID positive, Seiko Hashimoto says hard decisions will have to be made, including possibly cancelling individual events. With just a month to go, the Olympic Village is ready to house more than 12,000 athletes from all over the world. They'll be shuttled in and out to be tested every day, and they will have to dine alone. There's even a fever room. Local spectators will be able to attend the games, the organizing committee announced on Monday, but venues will operate at only 50% capacity, no more than 10,000 socially distanced fans per competition.
You could still decide to have fewer spectators, maybe even no spectators.
Yes, that's always an option, she says. When the games get underway, four new sports will make their Olympic debut, including surfing. Caroline Marks, one of four surfers on Team USA.
And I'm excited to hopefully put on a great performance for to show the world.
Tonight, Hashimoto says every athlete deserves a gold medal just for making it to these long-awaited games. Keir Simmons, NBC News, London.
And coming up for us, the governor of Texas may have outdone himself this time. The story when we come back.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Last thing before we go tonight, if you're a Trump or Republican, there's really no limit to what you can say to fire up the base. You can gaslight with the best of them. You can lie with impunity. Generally, the rule is say or do the most shocking thing imaginable, and that's how you stay on brand. Which brings us somehow back to the rootin' tootin' Trumper governor of Texas, Greg Abbott. His state doesn't have a dependable power grid, and yet he's going to build his own wall on the border, and he's being richly rewarded by a visit from his guy Trump next week. If Abbott wants to, say, run for president, he must be more further ensconced in a particular area of Trump's anatomy than even Ron DeSantis of Florida, and that won't be easy. Sure, the pretend outrage over critical race theory helps Abbott. So does the voter suppression bill he's been working so hard to enact, and that guns for everyone legislation he signed. But now he's outdone even himself. Today, and we quote here from the Texas Tribune, he vetoed a bill known as the Safe Outdoor Dogs Act. The bill would have made it illegal, and if you've ever loved a dog, this will appear to you to be common sense. It would have made it illegal to chain up dogs and leave them outside without drinkable water, adequate shade, or shelter. It also called for a ban on tethering dogs with heavy chains. Quote, Texas is no place for this kind of micromanaging and overcriminalization, said the governor in the veto statement. That goes right to the base, or at least it's designed to. Now tonight, the hashtag Abbott hates dogs is trending. Remember the rules when you're trying to appeal to that Trump base. Nothing can be shocking or outrageous enough, because Abbott figures apparently dogs can't vote. And really, what have dogs ever done for us? The latest news from Texas to take us off the air tonight. That is our broadcast for this Tuesday evening, with our thanks for being here with us. My thanks to my friend Chris Jansing for filling in for me last night. On behalf of all our colleagues here at the networks of NBC News, good night.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.